Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
So he's like working his way through the visual storying, which then turns into the script, instead of starting with the script and then moving on to storyboards, because the visual seems so much more important for him.
That makes a lot of sense, though, because there's like a huge addition to the third act of Totoro that honestly makes the movie. And he said it wasn't in the original story, but he like was working on they were in production of the movie, and he was like, wait a minute.
Right.
We don't really have a third act. Hold on.
This one ends kind of abruptly too. At least in my mind, it did. Like, you're on this journey. Yeah. I remember watching us getting close to the end. Like, how are they going to wrap this up? She still has her parents. She's still got to turn, you know, figure out what's going on with Haku. Like, it felt like there was so much.
We should talk about.
And then it wrapped up.
We should talk. Yeah, we should. We shouldn't talk about the third act until we address some of the other acts.
But it's not like the most linear of storytelling. So.
You're on Midnight Local, the podcast from How to Drink, where we just talk about things.
Movies.
Pop culture.
Maybe some video games.
That too. All the things.
Things. The stuff and things.
All of the stuff and the things on Midnight Local.
Let's get to it.
All right, Meredith, let's talk about Spirited Away. Is that how we start the show? We just say that? I can never keep this straight. What are the rules?
Well, we don't ever start the show. Our wonderful editor finds a funny moment from the show and starts it for us. So that's kind of nice.
That's great. That's great. A funny editor. Do that now. Get to work. Yeah. And show. Do you have this problem? I make your face as big as I can on this screen, and I put it right under my lens, but my eyes still want to look at me. I'm still self-obsessed. I can't stop looking at my own eyeline.
I'm a little afraid to fuck with anything right now.
That's fine. I want to tape over my own face, so I only look at you. Maybe I can open a browser or something and slip it over it. There we go. That's it. Yes, I just put my calendar over my face. That's perfect.
Yes, I've expanded you, but I'm a little human right in the bottom of the.
That's what I did. Yeah, and I'm still looking at my own little human because I'm a narcissist. I am like Narcissus, who will look at his reflection and starve.
My eyes slip down there from time to time.
A little Greek parable for you there. Speaking of that, I've been playing this game obsessively. We did an episode on it. The Hades.
Oh, yeah.
Where you play the son of Hades trying to escape from Hades. We did it. I played it a little bit before, but now I'm obsessed with it because I put it on the Nintendo Switch and I can play it in bed every night, which is better than doom scrolling. I will fall asleep playing a game. I will never fall asleep doom scrolling. So I put the phone on the other side of the room. I play Hades. And I die, and then that's bedtime.
Since Twitter's gone down the tubes, I've been...
It's now X.
Well, you know, whatever. Not to me, because I've stopped using it completely, but it's really helped with doom scrolling. I am on Threads so far. I just don't doom scroll on that in the same way, which is fine.
Yeah. I created a Threads account, but they don't have a dark mode yet, so I can't use it until that exists. I just can't look at it that way. All right, let's talk about the movie Spirited Away. What year did this come out? Like early 2000s?
It came out in Japan in 2001, and then I don't think it came out in the US until 2003.
Have you seen a lot of other Miyazaki films?
So I come into this very green. Miyazaki and really on anime. I know we've covered it in How to Drink, and I would say that's about the extent of my knowledge. And
all right, so that's like
Avatar, which you like to tell me isn't an anime, which fine, but like that's what I'm working with.
It's anime inspired, but it's Western created show. Yeah. But all right, so wow. So we got to do a lot more Miyazaki on the show because I love Miyazaki. That guy can make a fucking movie. And because I personally think that because the sensibilities are very different from what you see in Western film and animation, that like it kind of goes places you don't expect it to. It's fun. It surprises me as a Westerner. I wonder if to a Japanese audience, it would be surprising. Probably not. They probably, you know what I mean? It's probably like ho-hum, but for me, it's like, whoa, this is cool.
I think like some of the stuff that I'm reading just to get a background of Miyazaki and an understanding for the film is that he is kind of the Walt Disney of Japan, which I think he would hate because he hates
Disney.
Yeah. He says it's too low act, as easy entry into the film. It doesn't trust its audience, stuff like that. But I think for
all true
the Japanese sensibilities, he hits in the way that Disney hits to our sensibilities.
Although Disney loves Japan loves Disney too, which is why there's a Tokyo Disney and a lot of that over there. I mean,
I would love to go to Tokyo Disney.
This is How to Drink wants to go there pretty bad. So we're either going to have to take a long boat or I'm going to have to get into some serious flying therapy or something.
I don't know. Like take a boat to Europe. I mean, yeah, you have to take several boats in that case.
You could take a boat to Europe and then you can overland all the way to the east coast of China and then take a ferry to Japan. You can do that.
It's a year-long trip.
I feel like you need a top hat and steamer trunks for that. Like, you know, it's like, we're going abroad. Ha ha, you know.
We shall be back. We don't know when.
Probably a hot air balloon would be involved at some point.
Horseback riding.
Zeppelin. Yeah. Horseback. We took the overland route instead of the Yellow River. No, I really like his movies. I only came to them a couple years ago or a year and a half ago, I guess, really. Maybe 2 years ago because they were on HBO Max. And I was like, I've never really checked out any of these. I like half watched Princess Mononoke when it came out. I have not yet revisited it. At the time I was like, what the fuck is this? But my kid loves all of them. So it was, I have the experience of watching all of these with like a 5, 6 and now 7 year old and seeing it with her. And it's a totally different experience. And also kind of like wading into that slowly because some of these are not super appropriate for like a 5 year old. In fact, I was worried about Spirited Away because it seemed like it was gonna be scary as hell.
Yeah.
It's her favorite one. She wants to watch it constantly.
I was gonna say, it feels dark to me in the way that like 80s kids movies feel dark. Like it just sort of has a more tangible feel to it. So I would think like, The witch in the movie feels somewhat to me like, even though they're very different, the like bad guy in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which isn't animated, but like I got the same sort of just like crawly feeling.
I was gonna say, like, as I like what you say about the 80s things, but then like it still pales. Like if you look at Atreyu dying in Neverending Story or whatever, like some genuinely traumatizing events. Like there's no happy endings in some of that shit.
The Neverending Story is a great example. Yeah.
That horse stays dead, baby.
Yeah. Well, and even like the characters that you like, that you're, that are like your good guys that are with you feel, I don't know, creepy in a way.
Yeah. I have very limited exposure to that and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I think I've seen Neverending Story.
Okay.
Once, but I remember the sequel quite well though, Paw 2. It never ended, but then they made more of it. I don't know.
Well, it's never ending. They keep making it.
Yeah, just seem never ending sounds circular. So how do you? What is that, like a tangent, or is it like a wart on the side of that circle? How does that work? A little growth? I don't know.
An addendum.
So what did you think of this movie?
So
it's your first Miyazaki. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So here's what I get the sense of. First of all, I really liked it. I think that animation in the US has started to get a little boring for me, with the exception of, not to say the exciting things aren't happening, like across the universe, the Spider-Man movies are really cool. They look different. They feel different. But as far as Disney animation, it's all got the really puffy sort of Bratz dolls. Like it just is starting to feel the same.
Yeah. Well, they took that from anime. That's a Western, that's anime inspired ideas through a Western lens. So what if you look at the history of like Disney animation specifically, they call it neotenization, which comes from neonatal. So they neotenized all of the characters by giving them the proportions of a baby. So their eyes get huge, their mouths get small, their heads are like, you know, physically I think I've seen some anatomical designs. Like if you looked at like, you know, Anna's face from Frozen, but you peeled off her skin and looked inside her skull, she would have like eyeballs the size of grapefruits. There's no room left for a brain, which actually makes a lot of sense. So that's actually, and if you look at anime, like that's a big thing from anime that differentiated it from Western animation is that like the faces are neotenized, you know, or kawaii if you really want. You watch like Snow White, like she has normal human mm-hmm. features because she's at least partially rotoscoped.
Well, and it's just everything looking the same now. It's just like, I don't know. They could all
homogenized.
Exactly. Like they could all live in the same exact world. And like, I'm excited to see this Ninja Turtles movie coming out just because it looks different, just because it's something different to look at. And, you know, I'm looking at a picture of, I'm looking at the Spirited Away poster right now. And like, she's interesting and beautiful. And you've got the little rosy cheeks and these like iconic things can that draw you to this character that I just don't feel drawn to.
I will say, I mean, you talk about it being different, but like once you go down the rabbit hole, like there's not that much variation in me specifically, like there's a Miyazaki style.
Sure.
You know, like it's going to look pretty much the same to the extent too, is that like, I think he even recycles and Disney does this too. Like they recycle character designs where like, oh, like, you know, that's, I saw that person in the background of this other movie. They just took that face and used it again.
Yeah. And I'm just saying where I'm at right now with US mainstream animated films, turning this on and watching it was really refreshing from the start.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though his movies might all have a unified look. Like for me in this moment, I was immediately drawn into the story just because it was something different and beautiful and fun to look at.
Yeah. You got to watch like, so, and you were talking about the anime that we've looked at on How to Drink. That's all like modern shonen stuff, basically, which is a totally different. In the same way that we look at all rum as being a category, mm-hmm. it's really not. Like, you know, pot stilled rum is so different from column stilled rum, is so different from a rum agricole. Like, it's, they should be considered completely separate spirits in my mind. To look at anime as a singular category or a singular genre, which is even worse, is really dumb because, like, shonen is so. It would be like saying Degrassi is exactly the same as Gone with the Wind because they were both made in the West.
Yeah. On film.
You know, like it's
live action. Well,
I don't even know if Degrassi, I guess Degrassi probably. Was made on film.
It started on film at least, but it's live action Western. Yeah.
Three strip or three.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, you say like a Western is exactly the same as Blade Runner. You know, it's like, that's insanity. So actually Degrassi is a better example, or Saved by the Bell. Because really that's what Shonen is marketing towards, is like 14-year-old boys, basically. And so it speaks the language of 14-year-old boys. Miyazaki movies are not that mm-hmm. at all. In fact, I, you know, maybe less this one. No, this one too. But like when I was watching, you got to watch Totoro, which is phenomenal. I love Totoro. Love that movie to death. But like you watch that and like the opening sequences and stuff like that, and the way the camera moves and the way that he's like framed shots, it's like, oh, I just feel like I'm watching, you know, some great epic that was filmed in 1988. You know, I'm thinking of like The Last Emperor or something, with like these huge slow moving panoramas and like the slow reveal of this character as we get closer or something. It feels like you're watching Lawrence of Arabia mm-hmm, or something, mm-hmm. you know, like the way it's shot, for lack of a better word. There's nothing like that in Western animation.
Right. Well, and I read something interesting that like this was done. It was started without a script. Like he works from the visual storytelling. It is wild. Like I can read exactly what he says about that process, but
that seems hard in animation.
Well, it's not to say it was animated without a script. I mean, like he. Right. So here's what he says. He says he usually doesn't have time. So the story develops when I start drawing storyboards. Production starts very soon thereafter while the storyboards are still being developed. So he's like working his way through the visual storying, which then turns into the script, instead of starting with the script and then moving on to storyboards, because the visual seems so much more important for him.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense, though. And keep in mind, I mean, even Disney did that, right? They would basically storyboard the movie as script writing. You know, in the early days, you see him standing there at the big board, and they've got all the boards set up and stuff like that, and they're rearranging and changing it. And, but like, and also the other thing to keep in mind too with animation is that like production doesn't mean like location shooting. It could mean like the painting of background.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, getting actors into a booth to have them improvise and see what we get and stuff like that. So,
well, and if he's trusting that to be the thing that pulls the story along, it's unlikely he would feel the need to go back to the beginning of the film and make things feel linear, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense though, because there's like a huge addition to the third act of Totoro that honestly makes the movie. And he said it wasn't in the original story, but he like was working on they were in production of the movie and he was like, wait a minute.
Right.
We don't really have a third act. Hold on.
This one ends kind of abruptly too. At least in my mind, it did. Like, you're on this journey. Yeah. I remember watching us getting close to the end. Like, how are they going to wrap this up? She still has her parents. She's still got to turn, you know, figure out what's going on with Haku. Like, it felt like there was so much.
We should talk about.
And then it wrapped up.
We should talk. Yeah, we should. We shouldn't talk about the third act until we address some of the
other acts. Yeah, sure, we can. But it's not like the most linear of storytelling. So,
You don't think so? I mean, it progresses through time from front to back.
It does. But it's like you get your sort of problem and then you get like all of what feels like story chunks, like almost shorts within like the...
I could see that.
The smelly monster, the...
Oh, No Face. Oh, no, the smelly monster is... Shit, I forget his name too. He's not No Face. He is
like Stink Monster or something.
I think they just call him Stink Monster. I think
so, yeah. Yeah. And so that felt like its own short sort of within the movie for me, like its own little 15-minute thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think that part of that is just sort of like I was breaking it into a three-act structure. I think he's just like a little bit less glued to a three-act structure. You know, it's a meandering. Personally, to mansplain, I would say less that this is non-linear and more that it takes a meandering route through a couple different sides.
I'm with you there. And then it's like when he's done meandering, he's like, oh, let's finish the film. We got to have an ending. And it's just like, boom.
Yeah. We got to get to the end here. Yeah, I like it. I love that structure.
It's a musical structure to me.
No, that's interesting. I would not have
one of the
that.
Biggest. So for Boy Meets Girl, my like student film musical was that everything comes up to the like sort of science fair at the end of the movie. And then it all sort of wraps up very quickly. And it's like, but if you look at musicals, like Anything Goes and things like that, like you have this last scene where everyone's on stage and you realize this piece fits with this piece and these two people have fallen in love and it all just sort of is like, oh, and everything's fine. And that's kind of how musical theater is. So
there's like a lot of different little side plots and stuff. Yeah.
That all sort of wrap up in this final number moment.
So this movie opens, they're in the car, they are driving to their new home, and dad goes crazy. He like snaps or something and decides, let's take a shortcut through the woods, and drives outrageously fast through the woods.
Yeah, just like up that mountain. Well, they can see.
What is going
on? They can see the house, but they can't quite figure out how to get to it, if I remember.
I don't know. That I was watching, I was like, what the fuck? It's happening. It just seems, I forget now. Do the other characters even comment on like, oh yeah, you are driving like a crazy person, right? They do. She says like, slow down.
Mom might. But Chihiro is just sort of looking out the window and taking it in.
Right. Yeah. Mom's a little overbearing. They're both kind of jerks.
Yeah. She keeps saying like, I'm afraid. I don't want to do this. Like, and they completely dismiss the feelings of their child 100%.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It feels. Oh, wow. It feels like Labyrinth. I never thought about that before.
I'm not going to be able to fully. I've never sat down. I've seen Labyrinth in nightclubs. That's about it. Like, it's always playing in the background of some dance party.
Okay.
But I've never sat down and watched.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you should watch it. Well, it's a girl who is largely ignored and dismissed by her parents. And she asks the goblins to come and take away her baby brother. And thinks that's what she wants and immediately realizes she needs to get him back. And then in this movie, she kind of, you know, I mean, she kind of tries in the similar way without her really asking for it. The goblins come and take away her parents and she immediately has to embark on the quest.
Very similar. Yeah. Because in this one, her parents get taken. They start eating and then are eating sort of compulsively and then they turn into pigs.
Big old hammies.
Scary, 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 scary.
It's scary shit. Yeah. Yeah.
So your kids like this. They're not afraid that it doesn't.
Well, I don't know about the younger one. You know, the thing is, until a kid's like 2 years old, they can watch anything because they have no context. Like, you can watch just about anything with a 2 year old and they're just like, whatever. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what any of this is. So I don't know to be afraid of it. But yeah, even from like 5 or 6 years old, this was like her favorite one. She always wanted to watch it. And I was a little like, I want to see some of the other ones. but she, like, you know, because I like it, but it's definitely not my favorite of his movies. But yeah, she loves this movie. And I was hesitant to show it to her because seeing it, I knew there was some scary stuff. Yeah. And so, like, one of the things too that's like a little, you know, coming to this with Western eyes is like this movie deals heavily with concepts from Japanese folklore, obviously, that like I think are kind of innate or are, you know, just like embedded cultural knowledge in Japan that like we just don't have. Like, you know, like we know what vampires are. You know what I mean? But like, I don't know what Little Frog Boy is and stuff.
That's very true.
Like the soot sprites that show up in this show up in Totoro and maybe even a couple of other movies of his as well. Those are like a recurring theme.
Well, and I would imagine just even like cultural feelings and interpretations of animals, like vary from Western to Eastern cultures.
Yeah. Watch out or you might slip into the spirit world.
Right.
And if you do not eat their food. I mean, now that I'm saying that out loud, that sounds very Irish, actually. That sounds like the fairy folk, you know, you don't want to, it's a Gaelic idea.
Or like crossing the bridge is such a big, like immediate, like danger.
You got to hold your breath.
Yeah, exactly.
Or else you'll be visible. Yeah. There's some weird shit in here.
But it's all explained pretty well. I don't know. I know.
Oh yeah.
I know that they've added some lines into the, although I didn't watch it dubbed. I watched it with subtitles.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. Wow, that's interesting. Well, I was going to say, that was actually one of the things I wanted to say, is that like all of his movies, even like older ones, like the dubbed versions have like huge names doing all the parts, the big American actors in the roles, which I guess you missed out on. Not that it really matters, but like they're not like... And it's not like he gets bargain basement, you know, anime dub artists to come in and do like the Sunshine TV version of these things. Like,
well, in this one in particular, because like, so like a couple stats that are interesting about how this became sort of westernized is that it was like, or came to Western culture. They didn't really westernize it, but a little bit, it sounds like in the dub, because it sounds like they added some context that they thought might be necessary for people.
That's helpful
for me. So they say that it was the first film to earn $200 million in gross before opening in the US, which is probably what started to pique the US interest of like, we need to get in on this.
Yeah.
And then it was Disney that picked up and helped distribute it.
Yeah, for all of his hatred of Disney, like I think Disney is pretty involved in his business model. I guess they don't mind him biting the hand that feeds a little bit or something because he's a big deal. But
and he gives them a nod. Like I guess they go into Zaniba's house and there's a jumping lamp with the sound effect. That's a nod to the Pixar logo.
Oh.
Yeah, for all of his hatred, like there's definitely a copacetic relationship going on there.
If you watch Kiki's Delivery Service dubbed, Kiki's it's a great one. You'll love it. Actually, I think you'll really like that one. But Kiki makes friends with like kind of a surrogate mom, and she's voiced by the lady who does Daisy mm-hmm. Duck. It's distracting. Mm-hmm. It's distracting because like all I hear is Daisy Duck. You know?
Well, I guess he's just generally sort of a curmudgeon. Like I guess when iPhones and iPads came out and people became more connected to internet and AI yeah. and he hates all of this stuff. So
I've heard he's not the easiest guy to work with. I've heard this. But you know, anybody with like any auteur with a really hardcore vision is going to be that generally. Guy. And especially older people of sure. the industry. I mean, maybe, you know, of the industry, I don't know. Japanese industry is probably a lot different. So Walt wasn't an easy guy to work with either.
Yeah. So yeah, so they then that explains why like 2 years later it came to the US. I know that it did the festival circuit. It did really well there. So there was all of this buildup.
Won an Oscar.
Did it win an Oscar?
I think so, yeah.
I wonder if that was after its US release. It would have had to have been.
It would have been based yeah. on the US release, I think. I'm gonna look it up right now. But yeah, I mean all of his movies seem to get releases. I don't think any of his movies haven't been released in the US. I think
this was the first one though that really
Did big yeah. numbers, yeah. But he has managed I think he's got good relationships with Western production, you know, stuff.
Right. Well, the studio, yeah, studio is Ghibli. Is that how you say it? Ghibli. Or Ghibli?
I don't know if it's Ghibli okay. or Ghibli. Yeah, it's a good question. It's probably Ghibli or something like that, actually. And I'm sure some weebs are going to give us a hard time in the comments. I have been told, by the way, that is a non-slur that's acceptable to call Western anime fans weebs. So if I've offended people, I could switch to otaku. But I read a William Gibson novel where, like, there's a great, is it Itaru? I think it's Itaru, where they have to go to Japan and she's like, oh, that's my brother, he's an otaku. And she's like, oh, he likes anime, that's cool, can we talk to him? And she like won't let him talk to him. She's like, no, you don't understand, like it's a social contagion, like he's an otaku, like describing like an insult. Okay. Basically. Yeah, so I think that there's like a slightly different connotation in the West and the East about what that word means. So I don't know what you know, anime, Western anime fans. Awards. Was it not Spirited Away? Yeah, Academy Award for Best Animated okay. Feature. So I don't know why that didn't come up on the IMDb, but and it won it in 2003. So yes, it was based on the Western okay. release. That might be why it took 2 years, honestly, to get over here. It might have needed to. They might have been staging it to compete against weak ass shit. I don't know what else came.
Reasonable. I mean,
legit. Yeah. Like if Disney's going to pick it up and do the release, like that's absolutely yeah, on their like mind.
You will not win against one of our releases.
That, yep, that exactly right. That could easily be it. Because it doesn't take 2 years to record.
No, but they, or, yeah, know. That's why they threw it through the festival circuit and let it gain traction yeah. there. And, you know, it's still only grossed like 15 million in the US initially.
Well, certainly the audience for anime yeah. in the West is smaller than the audience for anime.
Which is wild because was going to film school what around like 2000, like right after this, 2003, 2004. And there was a poster of it up in one of my classes. Like it was just immediately.
Yeah, but like film school students care about.
Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely. Too. But so, I'm just saying it was such a big deal. And I remember always looking at the poster on the wall being like, I need to watch that. And here we are
yeah.
nearly 20 years later. And finally, I've gotten around to it.
There's like a really strong anti-consumerism message in this movie. Like, that is the theme of the movie. Like the central theme of this movie is do not overconsume.
Yes.
And it's repeated like in five different ways. You know, you got mom and dad who can't stop eating and turn into big old high imports.
Well, throughout the movie, you've got the big baby that's always eating too. Like the consumption of food.
The stink monster is actually a river like angel, but it's been polluted. Cause like, what if you look at what comes out of it, it's just garbage. That's why it's a stink monster.
So that was, that was based off of a personal experience where he was cleansing, he was helping clean a river and they found a bike in it, you know, amongst other trash. But I think it stuck with him that they pulled a full bicycle out of this river. And that's why
A bicycle would, it's funny, a bicycle would be one of the less offensive things I can imagine to pull. Yeah. I was like, well, that's a shame, but it's kind of not, I don't know. I have a hard time calling a bicycle pollution. It's just metal. It's just returning
it's
to nature.
It's what stuck with them. So, and that's why when funny. She's pulling on the handle and it becomes a bicycle.
The bicycle comes out first. Well, it's a great visual. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, when you see that the whole thing comes flooding out.
And then
the faceless.
And
yeah.
then no face. Yeah. His whole deal is that he's empty inside and he's trying to fill himself up. And he's filling himself up with the wrong shit. And he's buying his friendship with gold, spitting out gold everywhere.
So what other ways, what other anti-consumerism?
You've got Baba Yaga, which is an interesting westernization of that witch name, because like all she's got is gems and jewels. And she's like very concerned with that. And the entire spa, the entire movie, she's like hyper concerned with making money and with raising funds, and like it is a business. And so those are the big ones I can think of. And then you get this specific mirroring when you go to Baba's sister's house, and she's just like, I just like my humble little garden.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose the whole setup too of, because doesn't Dad say, you know, they built these little theme parks all over the place and then they weren't sustainable.
There was an economic depression.
Yeah, right. And so now they're all just sitting here emptied.
And I think they're moving at the beginning for a new job as well, which I don't know is on that point, but I could see like, whoa, that's ambition. And like there's it coincides with this message of consumerism. Like you should stay where your happiness is. You know, you're upsetting the apple cart here. I don't know for sure that that's intended or not, but I could see that being a component here. And also too, like there are moralities and messages and stuff that I am sure in this movie that are just like whew, right over my head because I'm not Japanese. So,
well, what I was going to say about like, did you like this movie? Didn't you? Like my first point is like, I feel like I need to watch it more. Like I feel like because it's not the way that my brain is, my Western brain is sort of wired, that it'll become like it's the type of movie that upon multiple watchings will become more, oh, this message, that message, you know, just like the first time you're just taking it all in. And I feel like I probably missed a lot in a single viewing.
I really liked it, but it is of the two of my least favorite Miyazaki movies.
So yeah, you've said, because for me, this is just the one that I know because this is the one that was marketed the most in the US, but you said amongst anime fans, this probably wouldn't be the most notable. So
I don't know about that. I mean, that I can't speak to, but I mean, certainly it's less popular than a lot of shonen stuff, but that's just because that's the cash cow, you know, like this is like kind of highbrow, you know, even by certainly by anime standards. And so to some extent, that's my objection to it, is that like, it's a very beautiful film. I love this movie. I am so glad this movie exists, but it does feel like a movie with a message, you know, like it's an artsy kind of film. And in and there's a message in all of the Ghibli movies and all of Miyazaki's movies, but like in the body of work, this one feels the most ponderous. I don't know, the most attempting to be weighty. Whereas like, you know, you watch Castle in the Sky, like watching that movie the first time, I felt like I was watching Star Wars for the first time again. Like it is so, and also if you've grew up playing Japanese RPGs, JRPGs, it's kind of insane to see that like, oh, this movie inspired the entire Final Fantasy series. Like every one of those games is just taking this movie and turning it into those, you know, those games. But like you watch Porco Rosso, which has its weighty moments for sure, but like also, you know what I mean? Like they're fun. They're really fun. Totoro is super fun, although in a similar vein as this, a little bit slower, a little bit heavier. I think you will really, really enjoy Ponyo, which is his version of The Little Mermaid. And I don't want to say anything more than that, except for the fact that it's like the weirdest acid trippiness movie, I think. Like it's very high on the levels of what the fuck. And definitely watch the dub because I don't know how it is in Japanese, but hearing Liam Neeson play the sea wizard is a joy.
I definitely gonna
like
have to
Tina
dive
Fey and stuff.
Wow, those
like,
are huge names. Yeah, I was going to say Spirit.
Oh, no. Yeah, dude.
Spirit, like, Away doesn't have huge names.
That's interesting. Totoro has Ellie and Dakota Fanning playing the two girls. And,
okay.
Like, a lot of other names. You know, like, yeah, it's pre... I also am not a huge fan of the world of Arrietty, but I don't know. Actually, maybe that may not be a Miyazaki. Maybe that might just be somebody else at Ghibli. It does have a very different visual. I think it is. It's a very different visual feel. It's kind of a retelling of The Borrowers, which is a story I'm not super familiar with. Okay. But the other Miyazaki movie that I think kind of misses the mark for me is Howl's Moving Castle.
Okay.
And that's, it just feels incomplete. It just feels like they forgot, like, there's an act or something that's missing from it, or like, you know, like somebody, you know, used to make film movies on reels, and it feels like, there's a reel missing or something. I don't know. I was like, wait a second, I'm confused by this.
His statement that he doesn't make the films make themselves is a little like that. I'm not surprised to hear that there are some things missing in that case.
There is I've heard this talked about in writing and applied to George R.R. Martin. Is that there's two kinds of writers. There's plotters and there are gardeners, and that George is a gardener, and that some writers, like, you know, a plotter would start with an outline and then turn that into a really specific breakdown and then start filling in the blanks, like, you know, more and more granularly until it's a whole book. Whereas a gardener kind of just starts writing and sees where it goes. And like the big thing, and I fully buy this because like this is kind of how I approach writing. When I write, specifically when I'm like writing dialogue and characters and stuff like that, is that he says, I did not plan. Because like the whole first book, you're expecting, and people have seen the show, so it doesn't matter. You kind of expect that it's going to follow this arc and that Ned Stark is going to be a major character.
First big shock.
And then out of the blue, Joffrey cuts his head off. And he says, I did plan that. That's why you think that. I did plan for Ned to be a major character. And then I was writing that scene and Joffrey just took the initiative. I think, you know, and to his point, he said, I think even Joffrey thought he was going to let him live until he decided he wasn't.
Yeah. Gonna. I think that's what makes his writing.
I totally get that.
Yeah. I was going to say for you, like, if you're plotting that, then, and you've planned this to be your main character, what would actually happen falls secondary to what you want to happen. And I feel like part of what makes him such a, like Game of Thrones, such a fun thing to watch is like Joffrey would cut off his head. There's no question about that.
He would.
And if he doesn't, you have to give him a reason not to, which just feels contrived.
I have so many things to say about Game of Thrones. I just decided we're going to do an episode on the show.
Okay.
The series. Have you watched all of it?
I've watched it.
Okay. Because I'm sure like I've heard some real feminist critiques of it as well. And I'm sure you would be able to bring those to bear. Or maybe you wouldn't. You're rolling
your
eyes.
Oh, no, I'm not rolling my eyes. I'm sighing actually because like, yeah, there's some seasons of that show that are really hard to watch for me.
I always counter with, this is what happens when you let roving bands of young men do what they want with weapons.
Can't disagree
and
with
that's
that.
The message and warning of the show.
I can't disagree with that.
Yeah, it's very feminist. You just don't like the way it looks, I think.
No, it's uncomfortable. I mean, I wouldn't. Yes. And we can go down. We'll save that rabbit hole. Yes.
It's an episode, obviously. But that is my central problem with it, is that the books, the characters do what they would do. And in the show, they do what the showrunners needed them to do. And I always call it seeing the hand of the writer, in that, like, I hate seeing the hand in the writer where it's just like this, I'm out. I can feel the writer's presence. It's ruined it for me. I'm done. And that's actually why I have a little bit of a trouble with like a lot of things that are quote nonlinear or where there's like a trick in it. Like I really didn't like, I was really put off by the first season of Westworld. Mm. And then I stuck with it a couple seasons after that. And it just like, it was always the same problem for me, which is that like, this guy really wants you to know that he's writing it, you know? And like, and it just,
I can't think of a specific example right now, but there are times when I am okay with that. There's like, here's an example. If I'm getting into a soap opera and I know I'm getting into a soap opera, I know what type of storytelling I'm into. And so that's fine with me. It's easy. It's like candy for your brain. You're on a ride. As you pointed out, I think last week or the week before in an episode, like everything has become soap opera.
That's what it is. They just call it something else. Yeah.
When you have something like Game of Thrones where it's like, no, this is like what would happen. So when I get to this point in my writing and I'm having to fight against my characters, I take a different route, then it feels less soap opera-y. Yep. It's not as gratifying for the viewer to lose the character that you've been attached to all season or excited to watch move forward. But like,
I think it's very gratifying.
I think so too. But
seeing a show go where it where no other show would go, to me, that's all I want. I don't care about tying up storylines. Life ain't like that. I fully reject Chekhov's gun. I say you put that gun on the shelf and maybe it goes off. I don't need that gun to go off. There's a lot of things in that room. I don't need the table to fall over either. I don't need it. There's a fireplace. I don't need anybody to use it. Maybe that room just had a fucking fireplace in it. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
But like Chekhov's gun is the perfect example of like, there's an agreement between the writer and the audience, and I'm not going to give this to you unless it has a payoff. And you hate that.
I do hate that. I truly hate that. I can't bite into that. And I honestly, like, this is, and it's not like a choice I made, honestly, like, but this is my central vibe in what I look for in storytelling and why I think so many people hate my takes. It's just like, I really deeply reject that entire notion. I think one of my favorite things I've ever seen is in The Pacific, which was a miniseries that they did on HBO. And there's this, I think he's like a captain or something like that. And he's like a really well-liked character and kind of a semi-major character. And he's like moving up the line. And it's like this really great oneer where it's like a single shot. And there's like, you know, a line of battle and there's guys moving to the front and back to the front. And he's like, I'm headed to the front. And he's got his aide-de-camp with him or whatever that guy's name is. And he's like shaking hands along the way. And the camera's kind of following him. And like, he's getting out of the frame and he's getting back into the frame. And you're following like all these little things. And then like all of a sudden he's coming back into the frame from the other direction, dead. And you never see it happen. Mm-hmm. It happens off screen. And it's just like, I don't know. That to me felt so, that's right. Mm-hmm. You don't get plans. Plans don't happen. It's like, I think you can inject any random, it doesn't have anything to do with the plot. You want to throw some random, like, and then they got hit by a bus. And now we're doing this story in a different direction. Why'd they get hit by a bus? Because there was a fucking bus there. You know, like, I am fine with that. That doesn't bother me at all.
I would say I'm fine with that too. I would say if everything has to be that way, then it really limits sort of the possibilities of storytelling.
It's sort of like how my relationship with Breaking Bad, which is going to sound stupid. People are going to hate this take, I know. But I watched season one of Breaking Bad. I kind of enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. But I was really into this idea of this guy having cancer and like how that makes plans for you that you didn't make. And by something that happens in the end of season one, I was like, oh, this isn't going to be about the futility of his trying to do anything in the face of this cancer diagnosis he's got. Like, I wanted a show where he just drops it, like in the middle of all of his plans. And it just, you know, he can't really do anything. Like, it's a show that's going to be sidelined and put into the background so that this character can do all the things that the writers want him to do. And that really, it just put me off of the show. I couldn't get into it after that.
I guess my read on it was more that like the cancer diagnosis gave him the freedom to be the person he would have wanted to be. But like, because like society doesn't let you, but then in a moment of desperation where you're like, well, life has screwed me anyway, so I'm going to do whatever it takes, finds out that he really enjoys being an asshole criminal.
Yeah, he did. Right. That's the idea. Well, anyway, that's what I'm saying though, is that, like, I just can't stand seeing the hand of the writer in the writing. It really, you're there. Invent characters, right? That's where you can come up with those. Invent a setting with rules. That's fine. Turn them loose in that setting and let them go where they're going to go. You're only there to just take notes on these people that you made up and not to steer them.
Well, and I think this is where like our consumption of media is very different, because there are times where I'm like, I don't want to see life as life would be. I want to see life as it could be.
I get told that a lot. Yeah. But I think that you can still tell that story. And I think that's from what you're telling me about Miyazaki, what your research told me is that like, that's what he does. But like, if you don't like where this story goes, go back to the beginning and populate that world with different people, populate that world with different plot lines, different rules. You know, all of that stuff in this movie happens because of decisions that were made before the first frame of the film begins. There is a polluted river demon who's going to show up at the spa. You know, this guy of no face does exist. And then all of the characters, you know, they interact in, you know, all of that setting exists. That's fine. Write the hell out of that. But then when those characters come to meet, when those plot lines, when those intentions are at crossed paths, just let them go where they want. Back to George Double R. Martin. I think that this is the reason Winds of Winter hasn't come out, because he kept talking for so long about trying to solve the Myrinese plot, where he needed all of the Myrinese knot, where he needed all these characters' storylines to interact. And I think that's him getting in his own way, because in the previous books, he would have never even worried about that. They just would have, these stories would have gone where they were going, but now he's trying to force it. And there's like, probably no way to do that.
With the like thesis of the way that he writes, how do you come up with a clean ending? Like, things don't end cleanly. They don't end resolutely. They sort of peter out or are anticlimactic in life. Like, you don't get this resounding moment.
Yes, I agree. I always think that like, you can either start the book from where you wanted to start the book and be happy with wherever it wants to end, the book ends, or you can start from the ending of the book and work back to where that beginning naturally needs to be. You know, I think that those are your two choices. I think that if you have a beginning and an end in mind, maybe you could write from the middle out. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I think that you run into some problems there.
Right. In something that's an epic world like that, it's sort of like, here's a period of time in which we are telling the history about this period of time. And I think that's
kind of,
I think your big problem with House of Dragon, right, was that. Right, but isn't it
that... I never watched it, so that was my... I don't have any problem. I don't know what my problem is.
But isn't it that there's some sort of like...
My problem with it was that I'm not interested in more HBO fantasy series.
But there's a text about this period of time that they're going back and filling in these holes, right?
Oh, so in... Yes, so that's my problem. That's a problem I have with a lot of Game of Thrones.
Okay, we're going to do an episode about Game of Thrones. We're so good
at this. Yeah, right. I will talk about Game of Thrones. It'll be a three-parter. I probably could be, and I think it would be fine. I think we could do a three-parter on it.
All right, back to Miyazaki and Spirited Away.
Yeah. The whole thing about names is a big deal here, which also feels very, very like Irish, very fey kind of goblin-y. Like they change her name.
Right.
So she doesn't know where she came from.
What I like about this is she's 10. So in the beginning of the movie, her...
Is she 10? She's young.
She's 10, yeah. In the beginning of the movie, her character was driving me absolutely bonkers because she's afraid of everything. And I'm like, okay, is this going to be about her overcoming fears? Is this going to be about her, like... You know, it was like, how do we get to the other side of just like spending 5 minutes at the beginning of every scene being like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. But I feel like 10 is an age where you realize that like your parents aren't perfect. Bad things can happen to you. Like I'm watching my nephews sort of go through this right now, that there is a randomness to good and bad things happening that can cause anxiety, especially amongst kids. Like you're not completely protected. Your parents don't know everything. And so I think with that comes like personal identity. And so what I like about her being 10 is like, she's at this moment of like becoming self-sufficient, self-oriented. And at that moment, if you change someone's name, like what does that do to them? Which is sort of what the Haku character says, like he's completely forgotten who he was before all of this, because his name was taken from him and now he's just that person living in this world.
I like that. I kind of just assumed it was a component of like folklore that like, you know, I don't know much about, but
I think right now it really is resonating with me watching one of my nephews in particular go through this moment of like, I'm not safe necessarily. And there's nothing that anyone can do about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured that one.
You did. I was like him. Everything was great. I even in like gymnastics, I just assumed no one would put me in a dangerous situation on purpose. And I saw arms break and things happen. And so
how nice.
I had a very rosy childhood. Very, very rosy.
Yeah, I know. I'm having fun. I think my favorite thing about this movie, above all else, is that there's no villains.
Yeah.
There are antagonists. But like even Baba Yaga turns out to be pretty okay by the end of this. You know, she's kind of playing the cards she's dealt and she's providing a service and she's more than happy. Like, oh, you played my game and you won. Okay, go on.
Well, and No Face is just going through his own shit. Like
he's got some trauma there. Yeah, he's exactly. Everybody just kind of needs a little healing.
Right. And the ways that they're acting that would hurt people are just because of their trauma.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, for him, for No Face, but
for him, yes. Yeah. Yeah. He's got some flaws.
Right. I agree. The witch, not necessarily. She's more tradition based. I don't know. Like,
I don't know. I feel like people are playing the hand they're dealt. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what happens to poor people in the spirit world, but like, she has decided it's not what she's going to be.
Yeah.
You know? and everybody really likes the spa. It's a very popular spot. People are very happy to be there. The people who worked for her are like, it's a good job. You know, mm-hmm. I'm glad to have this job. You know, nobody's like enslaved or anything like that, right? Am I mistaken? Or maybe I'm misremembering. I feel like it was...
The children kind of are. She takes them and strips their name and memory and identity and they become her workers. That felt a little...
How often does that happen?
Well,
I didn't get the impression that it had like really ever happened other than with what's her name? It's not Sasuke. That's
Chihiro.
Chihiro. But she changes her name to like Chia or something.
Sen. And then Sen. Haku. And I guess I could be wrong about this, but the other girl that she's sort of an apprentice to or is showing her around.
I thought she was some kind of like
the girl. Goblin. She's not a goblin. She looks human.
Everybody kind of everybody freaks out that Sen is a human when they're like getting in that bed. Nobody cares that she's a human or she never offers like, but so am I. Like, I don't think she's a human.
They do say in like 4 or 5 days, the scent starts to go away. Like you kind of, if you come into this world a human. So that's my read was that this girl came in a long time ago. Her name was changed and now she's become a part of this world. Her human scent is gone. But...
Maybe.
Again, I said I'd have to watch it 2 or 3 times to really like, yeah. And I could see my mind being very changed.
Yeah, I might have missed that. Who's your favorite character?
I don't know if I have one yet.
Spider guy.
Oh.
Boiler man.
You know, I do.
He's like, the best.
He was the safest I felt in the movie being around him.
Scary as hell, but totally like
there to help cool you. Guy. Yeah, I'm with you there.
He vouched for us, so she got the job.
And he's who she was sent to and has helped other people in the past. I have to say the big fat baby. I like the baby a lot.
The baby was weird.
The baby's weird, but I like that baby. But yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you on him.
She turns him into like a little thing at the end, doesn't she? Like he stops being a baby and starts being like some kind of little critter, doesn't he?
For at least a period of time. I don't know if he turns back or not. I can't remember.
What do you think about, is that a spa you'd want to go to? I don't know. It's like an interesting spa. Just like big vats of perfume water.
Yeah, I think it'd be really cool to go to a place like that.
I don't know what's the deal with that kind of a spa? I got no real basis for understanding. Is that like a recognizable spa in Japan? Or is that like, whoa, this is some crazy demon spa. What the fuck's going on here?
You know what I like? I like the belief that these mixtures of certain like scents and oils can actually cure your problems. Like I wish that like...
Can you sell me a license to sell more licenses?
What do you mean?
Sounds like you're going down the mid-level marketing pyramid scheme path there. Like,
no, but like... There is a part like that stuff works because you wish it to be true so much, right? So in a world that you've created where all of those things have value and do work and you can be like the guy in the basement who is a master at putting these combinations together and sending them up. Like I would love if that were real.
Oh, I like the idea. That'd be great. Yeah. If smelling like a delicious peppermint made my abs huge or something like that, that'd be great.
Or made your anxiety melt away. Like, yeah.
I can't relate to anxiety.
At all? Yes, you can.
Not really. I have very little anxiety.
Your anxiety, let's use specifically your anxiety about flying since it's come up in this episode. If you could smell.
That's true. I got that. I guess I do.
Peppermint oil and get on a plane. That'd be fantastic.
That'd be nice. It doesn't work. I've tried it. No, I haven't tried it. I do have anxiety, I guess, about being a good dad. That one freaks me out. I'm always.
There you go.
I often go to bed asking myself, was I a good dad today or like a ghost dad, a shit dad? And a lot of times the answer is, I was a shit dad today. I hate that.
But like, yeah, if you could go to a spa the day before a flight and it made you good to go, then that's a place I would absolutely love to go to if it existed. So that's the appeal. Yeah.
That'd be nice.
As far as the aesthetics of the place, I don't know. I have to watch it again.
You got to get on the elevator with a big radish man.
Fine with that. The stink monster, that not so good.
Yeah. Yeah, the stink monster, not so good. Radish guy, fine. Radish guy did seem kind of like a nice fella, you know.
Have you ever been to a bathhouse or a spa?
A bathhouse? No, I have not been to a bathhouse. That's for a culture that is not mine. At least as far as New York City bathhouses go.
New York City bathhouses are pretty mainstream. You can go to them if you want to.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking of ones that are downtown. That's like a gay scene thing.
No, not the Russian bathhouses. No.
Not really?
Yeah, no.
No? Okay. There was actually, I think for like an anniversary, yeah, I was looking into this I guess it was a bathhouse in, it was like some crazy Roman style bathhouse or whatever that they have downtown. My wife was like, no, that's weird. I don't want to do any of that shit. Yeah, she didn't think it was like a weird sex thing. She just was like, I don't want to get into some pool with other weirdos.
Right. They don't all have pools. Most of them are steam rooms. And then the pools that exist in the bathhouses I'm thinking of in New York are like the 50 degree pools that you pop into for like as long as you can handle it. And then you get out.
This place would like bathe you in wine.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's more of a spa. I would call that a spa. Yeah.
They're
like
doing a full on attempt to recreate like the spas of Herculaneum or something, you know, some ancient Roman shit. And to me, I was just like, awesome. That sounds great. That sounds fantastic. Yeah. But I don't think I want to be bathed in wine, but like, why the fuck not? Let's go Roman. Let's do it.
Yeah, sure. Let's try it.
Yeah. Anyway. I like the movie. I like it. Like I said, I don't think it's my favorite Miyazaki movie. I really like Castle in the Sky. We recently saw his, I don't think it's their, maybe it's their first movie. Nausicaa and the Valley of the Wind. Mm-hmm. That's a crazy movie. That's cool. And it's based off a manga.
And is that him or is that just the, it's the name?
No, that's Miyazaki. Okay. Yeah. I think it's either his first movie or it's like his first real movie or something to that effect. Kiki's Delivery Service is a nice little story. I like that one. Tale of the Heart's kind of boring, or is it Song of the Heart or something like that? We kept expecting something to happen in it, and like 3/4 of the way through, I had to explain to my daughter. I was like, I don't think this is the kind of movie where things happen. Just so you know, I was like, I think she's just like kind of learning to play violin or something. Like, I don't think things are gonna happen here.
There's gonna be a lot of pretty things to look at.
Yeah, well. There's another one called The Cat Returns that we had seen that blew our fucking, it's like one of the most insane things it's hilarious. It's bizarre. And the cat from The Cat Returns is also in that movie. And so we were like, great. I got to see the movie that The Cat Returns is a sequel to. Oh, wait a second. What the, this is like a different genre. What the hell is this? It's got nothing to do with The Cat Returns. No resemblance whatsoever. They're cool flicks. Totoro is probably my favorite though. I really, really like Totoro.
What this movie achieved is getting me interested in other Miyazaki films. So I guess
there you go.
That is a good sign.
Huge win.
And I won't let it be another 20 years before I get around to it.
No, we're going to do more on the show, but we're also going to do Game of Thrones. Apparently we both got a lot to say about Game of Thrones.
There's a lot to say about Game of Thrones. A lot of people got a lot to say about Game of Thrones.
Yes, they do. Still, so many years later. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if we could dust off Mad Men.
So I've only seen the first season of Mad Men.
Oh, wow.
But it's been always on my forever get to list. But
I always loved Mad Men. And lately I'm seeing a lot of people takes online that like, no, duh, like, Don Draper is the villain in Mad Men. You're supposed to see that.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it's a real simplification to call him the villain of the series.
I don't think he personally, but his kind, you know, like,
I don't know.
Yeah. I think like my aunt, I have an aunt who's in her 70s now, and she could not watch Mad Men. It was too triggering for her.
Other than having an affair, I don't really know what he did wrong, honestly, in that show. Maybe it's because I'm an awful dude.
I don't know if it's him personally, but it's like who he's trained to be, who he
Yeah, maybe that.
Yeah, like who he represents.
Maybe it is worth rewatching. I don't know. But yeah, I don't think I should ask my wife if she thinks he's the villain in it. I don't know if she sees that, but I should ask her. I don't, maybe we're watching different shows.
It might also be that like there's not a villain. It's just like the time period is the villain. Right. The, you know,
I feel like everybody,
the patriarchy is the villain.
Everybody kind of takes their turns being a piece of shit in it. Like Pete certainly is a huge piece of shit in the first season, mm-hmm. like a rapist. And I don't know if you can ever wash that stink off you, but by like the end, he's a much more sympathetic character mm-hmm. by the time you get to the final season. So I don't know.
And now we're on Mad Men.
Yeah.
In this episode, we're going to talk about all the future episodes that are yet to come.
yeah. I will. You know what just happened though? John Hamm got married to, you don't know this, but in the final season, he goes to like this.
I've seen images. So Big Sur. I do know that.
Yeah. And I think he's supposed to be hanging out basically with Alan Watts, who is
right. Like he's burned out on everything. Abandoned his life as a ad man.
Right. As an ad man.
Sure.
Well, he takes a step back from it. And while they were filming that in that location, he met someone. They started dating. Now they're married. You know where they had the wedding? At the location that they filmed the show. I don't know. I feel like a lot of people are like, that's my work. I want to have a life apart from it. Not this guy. No way, man. I just want to stay in that shoot. I really liked filming those scenes. I'm there. That's my marriage. I based my marriage on filming those scenes, man.
It's probably not all that intense, but it's like, that's cute though. If it's a scenic, beautiful place where you met, like, heck yeah.
Yeah. Kimmy Schmidt. What's that actress's name?
Ellie Kemper.
He was his drama teacher.
Really?
He was her drama teacher.
Funny.
Yeah. Before he got the gig. Yeah. And she grew up in some weird fucking shit.
I saw her speak live once at like a podcast taping, but
she was involved in some like Daughters of the Confederacy KKK shit growing up.
Yeah. Oh, really?
She was the veiled prophet of some like bizarro ball. And if you look at the veiled prophet wears, it's a fucking KKK robe.
I'm pulling this up right now, but
Ellie Kemper, fucking racism. Look it up. I don't think she's a racist, but she grew up in some Southern Gothic weirdo shit holdover from the Civil War. Yeah. There's some guy on TikTok doing like a whole, like, I'm going to do 1,000-part expose on it. But I'd known for years. It's just like, I was like, people are finally talking about that. Neat.
We listened to a podcast called Dead Eyes that was like about a guy who got fired from, was it Band of Brothers? What's the big like Tom Hanks HBO war?
Oh, you told me about this. He got fired for having dead eyes.
Right, because he had dead eyes, right? So he basically, like, the quest of this podcast is to get an interview with Tom Hanks and to like confirm all of these insecurities at this moment, like set in his life. But the reason I'm bringing it up is there's an episode, like at the beginning of the podcast, I was really hoping it would go more in this direction. He's talking to all of these famous actors he has access to about their like epic failures and how they bounced back from them. And he talks to John Hamm, who spent years being told that he just did not have a face or a demeanor or anything for television. He was never going to be a television actor.
Maybe he didn't. Maybe he had to grow into a face, you know?
Or the right part comes along and he's just the guy for it.
Right. But I mean, like, the dude's, but on the other hand, like, he's a classic man.
It took him so long to get there compared to others. Like, he really didn't get huge until Mad Men when he was well into his 40s.
I mean, I don't know if they went into this or not, but like, his real background is in comedy and in improv. And I wonder if that's what it was. He was going after these comedy roles and like, dude, like, you're a dramatist. Like, what are you doing? This is not the face for comedy.
That's why this guy ended up being a comedian. It's why he had access to John Hamm, because John Hamm's friends are all comedians.
That makes a lot of sense.
Which is why he shows up in Bridesmaids and he's like got a lot of those connections.
Yeah. Apparently he taught a lot of them how to be funny. Maybe. I don't know maybe it was like her high school drama teacher. The way I had heard it was drama teacher. And that to me means high school. So I mean, maybe he was like the high school drama teacher.
A lot of acting classes. It's like, it's a Barry style acting class.
Yeah, but you would never call Gene Cousineau your drama teacher.
I don't know about that. The people in his class.
You'd call him your acting coach, or you know what I mean? Like my drama teacher. Like that's between Jim and lunch.
That's true. I hear that. All right. You got anything else on Spirited Away?
We got to do more Miyazaki. I really liked it. I love the message. I really do. I did. It sounded like I shit on this movie. I love this movie. It's just not a movie that I feel compelled to revisit in the same way that I do. Like I would like to fall directly into Castle in the Sky and just kind of stay there. Or Porco Rosso, which I can't get anybody else in my household to rewatch with me, but that's okay. It's a really good one.
So what should I watch? What should I watch next?
I don't know. We'll figure it out off the air. Probably Totoro. Okay. I mean, Totoro is the only counterpoint is that like Totoro has a little bit of the same pacing as this. And I would like, maybe we should do something that's
because
wildly different from it. But Totoro is so like, I mean, it's the logo for Studio Ghibli is Totoro.
Yeah. This has a 2-hour and 5-minute runtime. It is long for an animated movie. And it did feel long at points. I will say that.
Yeah. And then maybe we should do stuff like Akira too, you know, kind of get off of just Miyazaki.
We should do an anime month or anime August. Anime August. We're already in August.
Yeah, as I said, we'd have to pivot hard. I'm not like super versed in anime. I know you know what I've never seen that everybody says, oh my God, I can't believe you never saw this Ghost in the Shell. But like I've seen Ninja Scroll. I've seen Akira. I've seen Cowboy Bebop. I have seen Big O, which sounds like it's dirty. It's not the Big O. No, but that was actually, it's really interesting. It's like almost a companion show to Batman, the animated series that was made in Japan. It's made by like the same studio that made Batman, the animated series, and has a weirdly like Japanese version feel of that. I really enjoyed that. I've seen episodes of Inuyasha, but like it's not shonen. That show is geared towards teenage girls, and there's a different name for that genre. I forget what that's about. I have zero interest in Full Metal Alchemist or in the big skinless demon show, Attack on Titan.
Oh, okay. See, the only reason I've heard of any of these things is because we have considered doing episodes of How to Drink on any number of them.
Yeah. Attack on Titan is past its irrelevance at this point, but like honestly, talking about the controversies around that show might not be the most uninteresting thing.
Right.
But like I know some movies and what they call the golden age of anime movies, like from the 90s and 80s, not so much from anything more recent. That's about it. All right. I think we should end this fucking episode.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That's how we're going to end it from now on. Show the fuck over. Thank you, Annie Villalobos, our producer extraordinaire. And
thank you to Heather Vaughn, who did the artwork for the show.
Phenomenal artwork. And Studio 71, our distribution partner and our most gracious partner. And I want to thank Meredith for doing the show.
And thank you, Greg, for actually making the show possible, for being Mr. How to Drink.
I'm going to just say you're welcome. For all of the glory that I am.
Perfect.